The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratovsky. On this week's program, we'll be looking at the evolution of music online as bands start selling their tracks through apps and sound streaming business models like Spotify continue getting traction in the mainstream. What is the future of Apple's iTunes? We'll also be looking at the latest tech headlines, including details of the lawsuits brought up against Google, Facebook, and Apple by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, and how open source technologies could save tens of millions of local council cash. Plus, Keith Stewart discovers some of the more innovative methods of monetizing digital content that the computer games industry is using, and how it might be useful for the wider web industry. Joining me in the studio to talk tech are the Tech Weekly Dream Team, Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media correspondent, and Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. Reunited at last.
Hi.
Welcome. Hi.
It's been a long summer.
It has been a long summer. We've been kind of overlapping, yet we have been keeping in touch via social media, which is very important, being technologists.
As one does.
I had a week away. I had a digital detox, and I am resolved now to not use Twitter nearly as much as I was using it before I went away.
Why?
I was checking it every 10 minutes.
No, it's true. A digital detox is good. If you take, you know, a week at least off, completely offline, is a really good thing to do.
Well, I was petrified. I borrowed a friend's cottage and it was literally in the middle of nowhere and there was no mobile signal, there was no internet, and I thought I was going to get raped and murdered. Culture of fear, and I wouldn't know what to do. Running down.
At least if you
tales.
Were going to be hacked to death, you could at least have tweeted it until the last minute.
No, because there was no signal.
Oh,
there was no connection with the outside world, Jemima. What are you to do?
Try having a baby, because it has much the same effect.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, stick around for the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Here's this week's news. Apple has invited a limited number of journalists to a launch event on Wednesday, which is widely expected to be the updated iPod. But analysis shows that quarterly sales of its iPod are at their lowest since 2006. The MP3 player only sold 9 million units to June, despite strong iPhone and iPad sales. As Charles wrote in the paper on Monday, the vanilla music playback device, the version without Wi-Fi, appears to be in terminal decline. The music industry has had to take notice. Until very recently, they've learned to rely on the iPod to drive sales through Apple's iTunes Music Store. But now there are competing business models looking fresh and viable. The clear frontrunner is the streaming model, like the digital radio service Spotify, plus a new conduit, the Humble app. Now, Jemima, explain to me, how are people buying music through apps?
Well, there are a number of really interesting models, actually. Last week we did a profile of Fire Player, which is a remixing toy, and there's two songs free through that app. And then if you want to remix another tune, then you pay to download it. They've only got deals with Universal and Ministry of Sound so far, but that's a really interesting idea. You can look at the Glee app as well, where you can, don't laugh,
and I'm sure you
don't
do.
Laugh, and I may have tried it, where you can download various songs and then glee over the top of them, go and glee yourself to your heart's content. So these are putting a kind of quite an imaginative new spin on downloading music. On top of that, there are more straightforward apps where you pay to download, and then presumably the developer takes a cut, Apple takes a cut, and then maybe the artists might take a cent or two somewhere down the line.
This reminds me a little bit of the PlayStation 2 model when they did their SingStar game, when they would introduce new tunes, or the idea was that they would introduce new tunes to the home karaoke machine, as it were, to the game. And then you, as the consumer, in order to get to the next level, you would have to listen to the song again and again and learn the lyrics and learn the tune and everything so that you could advance through the game. Quite a clever system of getting people to really get to know your song, isn't it?
Well, it's very clever, and if music labels have got any nous at all, then they will definitely be pursuing games and apps as a way of maximising their revenues.
Why is that? Why has this new direction happened instead of just relying on the old iTunes model?
Well, thankfully, I think because developers are injecting a bit of much-needed imagination into music retelling. I mean, people listen to music in all sorts of ways now, and I think acknowledging that they might be listening to music in a game or wanting to chop up music and do different things with it is actually a very sensible route to go down. And for music labels, I think they're wise to try and put their music and their artists on as many different platforms as possible, because as Charles analysed quite closely in his piece, revenues are looking pretty dire, so they want to try and maximise those in as many ways as they can.
Charles, coming over to you, thinking more about the streaming model, why is it that now streaming seems to be taking off? We've dallied with this kind of model in the past, things like Pandora in the US and even Last.fm. So why suddenly are things like Spotify working for labels? Why are We7 working for labels?
The first thing is that you're getting more pervasive internet access. You're getting 3G access all over the place. You're getting carriers which are offering data contracts, which means people can stream. And also you're getting lots more devices with Wi-Fi built in, all of which makes streaming easier. Plus, on the music label side, they've actually come to realise that, yeah, they actually need to license tracks for streaming. They don't make very much money out of them, but any money that they do make is a plus for them. And we did speak to We7 earlier this year, who were saying, a few years ago, they were going around to the labels and saying, we'd like to license your music for online streaming. And they just looked at them and laughed, pretty much. But the industry now is seeing that it has to do this. It has to find revenues because sales of CDs are falling year on year internationally. The digital music sales, the download sales, aren't increasing as fast as they want. So they're having to rely on this segment called performance, which last year was only worth 800 million worldwide. But the expectation is that it's going to increase quite dramatically with people like Spotify and Pandora and We7 all getting into the act. So if the digital downloads doesn't take off quite as fast as they want, possibly performance will start to make up the gap.
And what kind of threat do these services, whether they're Spotify, We7, or even the app services that we were talking about before, what kinds of threats do they pose to iTunes?
Well, iTunes is the biggest retailer in the US of music. The question is whether they're a threat or whether they're an adjunct. Does listening to something on Spotify mean that you never want to actually bother buying it? It's a bit early to say with that, but there are signs that Apple is seeing that as a possibility. For example, it bought a service called Lala, which was a music streaming service. What is going to come out of Apple having purchased Lala isn't clear yet, but there are some expectations that they'll make some sort of announcement this week.
It's really interesting, actually, that the discussion about iTunes versus apps, because what Apple has done is brought services like Spotify and all those other music apps, which were potentially competitors, has brought them right inside the Apple walled garden. So will they compete, or does it matter, actually, because they're all just within the shiny world of Apple now, even if these are standalone companies trying to look at revenues in all sorts of ways? I think it's very likely that Apple will launch that streaming service this week. Actually, for the music industry, they now have a real appetite for going to Apple because they trust that infrastructure, that walled garden is bolted down, and they know, even if they're not very much in terms of revenues, they know that they are going to get revenues from those deals.
What can they do, though, to remain at the forefront? Because they've been hugely successful in terms of the sales, in terms of,
Well, let's be quite clear. Apple is not interested in innovating in apps and new little business models. It's about the hardware. It's about selling stuff that makes them loads of money. And I don't think Apple ever intended to be the biggest music retailer in the US. What they did intend to do is just have some juicy content that will make people buy their hardware, because that's where they make their money.
Now, coming back to hardware, the launch of the new iPod this week, will this make a dent on their figures? Will this change anything, do you think?
I think that the plain iPods, the iPod Shuffle, the Nano, and the Classic, there's no real expectation that there's going to be any sort of particular change for those. There are rumours about the iPod Touch, which is the one with Wi-Fi and which can run apps, about that getting the Retina display like the iPhone 4 and getting cameras so that it can do Apple's FaceTime video calling thing over Wi-Fi. There's also some expectation that the Apple TV is going to get relaunched and that it will have the same operating system as the iPhone and the iPod Touch and the iPad, so that it'll become more of a sort of an app sort of thing, rather than at the moment where it's something which sort of runs a bit like a Mac computer, but it doesn't, and it's sort of...
Well, they had to really improve the proposition for Apple TV, because it was just a mess. It was like, how would you describe what that service actually does? Your TV content sort of lives on it, and you plug it into your telly. But just, yeah, it was a mess. So maybe they'll do something with Apple TV, but yeah, to have to be a lot clearer than the last proposition.
It sounds to me like they're going to be sticking with the tried and tested, and also things like adding bells and whistles to some of their existing content.
It's all about putting apps on the telly, you know, whether you're Samsung, Google or Apple. So that's the direction to watch, I think.
Yeah, interesting question about what happens to the owners of old Apple TVs, whether those can somehow magically be updated or whether people are going to have to live with those, and that becomes
doorstops,
a strange
paperweights.
Sort of hinterland. Yes.
Really expensive paperweights. Well, yeah. We will come back to this next week when we find out all of the news. Also this week, witnessed a clash of the digital titans as the company linked to Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen brought a lawsuit against 11 companies, including Google, Apple and Facebook. The alleged infringement is about patents for search and e-commerce, also used by well-known online brands eBay, AOL and Netflix. Charles, what's the story here? This is a bit messy, isn't it?
It is quite messy. Paul Allen was the co-founder in 1975 of Microsoft with this guy Bill Gates, who you may have heard of. But he actually left the company later on to be treated for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, from which he recovered. And he also set up a company called Interval Research in the early 1990s. Now, that sort of got busy. They had a lot of people who were coming up with all sorts of ideas to implement various things. And Interval Research filed for about 300 patents during its life. It then shut down, and all of its intellectual property was shifted over to a company called Interval Licensing. And what's happened is that Interval Licensing has gone through its patent list and is saying that people like Google, like Apple, like Yahoo are infringing on those patents in various of the things they do. For example, there's one which was an application filed in December of 1996 and issued in July 2001, a browser for the use in navigating a body of information with particular application to browsing information represented by audiovisual data. Could be sort of a bit like iTunes, or could be a bit like YouTube. And there's others of alerting users to items of current interest. The question comes down to whether these patents have actually been issued correctly. Were the ideas behind them obvious, in which case they're invalid, or were they things where Interval Research really did come up with a new way of doing something? And Google has said that they're going to fight it, and various other Facebook as well has said they're going to fight it. It could be hundreds of millions of dollars for Interval Licensing if it comes right. But it could also mean that the whole way that the US Patent Office functions is shown up to be one where it just gives patents too easily.
And also certainly the question of cyber patents, you know, what does this say about the traditional patenting system as we know it now for web and for cyberspace?
Patenting is about something where you patent a process. It's quite easy to understand in the physical world that you can patent a new way of doing something, something that's not obvious. But when it comes to software, there's a lot of disagreement about the extent to which you can patent software, to which you can patent a process, and whether something is obvious, because people might say, well, it's completely obvious that, you know, one of the patents covers the sort of, if you like that, you might also like this. And people would say, well, databases have been doing something like that through full text search and suggestions for ages. The US Patent Office is becoming notorious for these sorts of rows, and there's a lot of argument and a lot of accusation of people being called patent trolls.
I love that expression. What is a patent troll?
Patent troll basically sits underneath the bridge, waits for someone to pass over with something rather useful that is covered by its patent, jumps up and sues them.
I'm in the patent troll school of thought on this one, actually. I think the thinking is that all of the companies named in this suit are going to really aggressively defend this, and they'd have a very good case. It just sounds massively opportunistic. And who'd heard of Interval before this? You know, it just stinks of very unsubtle PR campaign.
Well, it's true that people do say, well, you know, if you had these great patents, why didn't you implement any of them? Why didn't, you know, why is it we've never heard of Interval?
I think that in 2015 there will be some sort of flying vehicle that may hover.
Quick, send it to yourself. Patent it now.
Put it in an envelope and don't open it and post it to yourself.
But it's part of the problem. I mean, equally on the patent front, Microsoft has applied to the Supreme Court to get a review of a patent that it's happened to pay out on to a company called i4i, which had a patent on various uses of XML. And actually, i4i is a company which has been, you know, doing things with its XML system, very effective things. So, you know, there the implementation is clear. I think there is an argument that companies which don't implement stuff and which haven't implemented it, you could sort of say, well, there's a bit of a question about this.
Well, that's the thing. It's one thing to have the idea. It's another thing to have the idea
and the
simultaneously and the funds and put the investment in and actually build it and improve on that idea.
Except a lot of inventors would tell you that getting the funds is pretty near impossible sometimes. You can have the great idea, you know, the sort of the Dyson stuff is an example of this. You know, the vacuum cleaner that made, you know, James Dyson so famous, it took him years and years and years and years, having had the great idea, the patentable idea, to actually turn it into something. And he then had to defend his patent very, very hard. So sometimes, you know, the patent inventor fails to implement it, but not for lack of trying.
Well, read more about the suit as it unfolds at guardian.co.uk/technology. Finally, as the government continues to cut budgets and the reality of the next few years of austerity looms, local councils are seeking ways to provide the services their residents expect, but more efficiently and at lower costs. One option is to move away from the proprietary technology systems and towards open source solutions. Charles, you spoke recently with the council at the Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead, who are trying out the open document format. What are they doing there?
Well, I spoke to Liam Maxwell, who's the councillor who's responsible for IT policy there. And he's part of a sort of a Tory group who really want to push down the costs of government IT rather than cutting by simply saying IT as it's used is very like building materials. You know, you don't actually have to get a really specific particular one. You know, a lot of this is widely known. So they're trying to push towards the open office, open document format, which would mean they could have cheaper desktops, which means that you can just cut your budget for IT for pretty much no effort.
And what have they been traditionally using? Have they been using the sort of named brands?
It's all been on Microsoft Office, standardized on the Office formats. And the difficulty there is that although you can say, well, okay, we're not going to use Microsoft Office, we're going to use OpenOffice, you do have the problem that you have certain incompatibilities between versions of Office formats and what OpenOffice can read. If you don't have it mandated from the centre, from Cabinet Office, where Francis Maude is in charge, then you have a lot of trouble actually getting your IT suppliers to work in the same way. They will keep on sending you Microsoft Office stuff, which may be incompatible with what you're using. They have a bit of a chicken and egg problem. You know, they want to move, but they're waiting for the Cabinet Office to mandate it. And the Cabinet Office is sort of saying, well, go on then, you guys. I'm sure you could do it a bit. And also the Cabinet Office has slightly bigger fish to fry.
So what we've got is some of the problems, some of the hurdles that they have to overcome are not just the compatibility issues, which, you know, you always get with software, frankly, but also the fact that the people in the center, the people at the top, aren't really embracing the open source technology. Is that right?
Francis Maude does want to move it. He does want to do this, and he said that he will, you know, during the government's term. The problem is simply one of coming up with the plan of how you're going to do it, the timetable for how you're going to do it, what sort of cost savings you expect to make eventually out of it, how much you're going to have to put in because you've got to do all the support costs and the change,
the control. The juggernaut, you can
all these
see
things.
It,
yeah,
it's so it, slowly it really is, moving.
Liam Maxwell put it to me. He said, you know, it's a supertanker. You're trying to turn a supertanker. But of course, you know, supertankers, once you change them around, then they sail very effectively. So it's a big question as to whether they can do this. But there are very clear benefits to be gained. In Spain, the cost of running a local government desktop is about £130 a year. Compare that to Windsor and Maidenhead, where it's about £350. And in local government, it's from £800 up to £1,600 per year, per desktop. That's a lot of money.
That is very, very significant. But one other problem, though, is the support. You know, you've got people who are, a lot of people in government are not technologically savvy, frankly.
And that's true, but which is why you need to have the centrally mandated changes and you need to sort of think about, okay, how are you going to support it? How are you going to, you know, do the change control? Because you have to look at the end target, which is that it's a lot cheaper. And that you may say, well, we're having to spend a bit more on support to begin with. Yes, to begin with, you will. But you have to look at it as a long-term thing. So, for example, the Dutch government has mandated a lot of use of open source standards. And they've seen all sorts of benefits. They've seen an 8% cost cost reduction, quality improvements in municipal government, 22% since implementing it in about 2008. So there are benefits from it.
Well, you can read up on the Guardian's own open source tools and apps at guardian.co.uk/technology and stay with the website for more on the latest tech news, including the furore over the change in the design to social recommendation site Digg. Oh, come on, get your handbags out, people. Really, does it matter so much? This is clearly a bugbear of mine. And the latest on the battle between BlackBerry and the governments of countries around the world, which, Charles, I believe India has said, okay, it's fine.
India's given BlackBerry 2 more months. So they haven't said it's all okay. They've said 2 more months to discuss it. So
extendedly.
It's one of those sort of lines in the sand, most literally, where you sort of say, okay, here's the line in the sand. Okay, you stepped over the line. Well, okay, I'm going to draw a new line over here.
Well, you can keep up with those as they appear. The games industry is typically one of the most technologically innovative parts of the new media business sector, developing new solutions and pushing hardware in directions unimaginable to most people. However, until recently, it relied upon a very traditional system of sales and marketing, despite its inherently digital and thus non-physical makeup. Over the past 2 or so years, games publishers and indie developers have started to look at new ways of monetizing their digital content, including micropayment systems and encouraging in-world economies. Now, as Keith Stewart discovered when speaking with Tim Clark, editor-in-chief of First Play, it looks like the games industry is back in innovation pole position. Once again, digital developers in other new media sectors can learn from the solutions gamers implement. Keith began by asking Tim what the future was for online digital content.
Well, I think it, to a degree, digital content is a future for everyone, right? Like the delivery of video and the delivery of kind of rich multimedia is something that everyone's going to have to get to grips with. How you get people to pay for that is clearly currently a thorny issue. And if you look at gamers as kind of a demographic, historically they paid in magazines quite high cover prices in exchange for exclusive access and also for being able to get hold of software early or software that they couldn't otherwise get hold of. I'm speaking about demo versions on the discs. So you would say that gamers are kind of should be quite predisposed to being willing to pay for stuff like that online. But by the same token as well, they're an incredibly savvy market and they don't like feeling ever like they're being gouged. Who does? So you can kind of look at it both ways. But for all companies, I think, whether it's Future or Condé Nast or IPC, how to monetize their digital, and what a terrible word monetize is, but how to make cash pure and simply out of those audience, be they specialist or mainstream, is an incredibly challenging thing. You look at, you know, what the Times is doing and, you know, people openly laughing at them, but I think they're pretty brave trying something like that. And so, yeah, we're all, I guess, experimenting is what I would say. But, yeah, it's incredibly important. The way people consume our kinds of media has changed irrevocably, and we either engage with that, start delivering what people want, or give up, really. I mean, I just come back away from holiday, and I was looking at the wired iPad app out there. It is just beautiful. It's, like, incredibly slickly done, and I think there's really obvious parallels for stuff we could do in games. And if you look at the kind of content we're creating on First Play, how that could be kind of leveraged with the magazine to make an even more rich thing. I mean, it's a way off down the line, but, yeah, we'd be crackers not to be doing it.
If we look, say, I don't know, 3 or 4 years down the line, at the moment there's really only kind of one service like First Play, but there's still a lot of magazines and a lot of websites. Do you see those ratios changing in the next sort of 3 or 4 years? Do you think in 4 years' time there'll be much, much less magazines and many, many more services or programmes like First Play?
Well, I mean, I think it's about brands, isn't it? And I think the official PlayStation brand, whether that be print or a future, hopefully, web offering or what's currently First Play, how they interact, I think there will still be a very strong official PlayStation brand, because fundamentally it fulfills a need, which is for people to have good access to insider information about the PlayStation platform. I don't see that going away. It's how we deliver it, I'm sure, will change, but then it would be a braver man than me, and I'd have a sexy job at a bank being an analyst, probably, if I could call where the console market would be in 4 years' time. I think all the three hardware manufacturers are clearly still pretty desperate for their boxes to be these huge content hubs delivering all kinds of things, and I think one of those things, I'm sure, will be video game editorial, be that kind of video or text or being directly into your brain via your hollow chip. I think the good will out, you know, and I think that whoever delivers the most interesting, most entertaining editorial as ever will be the one that thrives, whichever the medium.
But as we're getting more technical And what you provide is much more closely tied in with games content. You know, a lot of the multimedia we see, there's not a lot of critical components to the multimedia. When I look at video stuff on GameSpy, GameSpot, on IGN, it's very much, it's almost multimedia advertorial in a sense. Are you worried that as we go more into a kind of technical digital era of video game journalism, that we're going to lose this, what sense we have now as the magazines being a kind of a midpoint, a consumer's champion in this industry?
Well, I write for an official, or have worked on an official magazine for a long time, and you're forever accused of bias, and to which I'd sort of say, well, what would we be? It would be odd stance for us to be pro Xbox, and the way I see it is kind of like enthusiasts for PlayStation, but by the same time, I would stand on the record of the scores we've given over the years. There's no reason why they can't be as controversial and consumer benefiting as ever. But I mean, as to whether like the current ones out there are full of advertorial, I mean, I don't think so. I think there's soft stuff, but I think games journalism is still quite aggressive when it needs to be.
Tim Clark from First Play speaking with Guardian games blogger Keith Stewart. For the latest headlines and up-to-the-minute news and features on all things game, head to my old alma mater, the award-winning guardian.co.uk/games. You will literally find everything you need there. And if you can't, head over to Tim's firstplay.co.uk. That'll also do. That's it for this week. There'll be more on games next week as we take a look at how important audio is in our interactive immersion and new business models for developers. If you want to comment on any of the items we ran today, do get in touch on Twitter at GuardianTW or come tell us about it on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thanks to our studio Tech Weeklyites, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Our producer was Ian Chambers. I'm Alex Kratowski.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.